This is Germany calling. Germany calling North America. Stations DJB on the 90-meter band at a frequency of 15.2 megacycles per second. Station DXB, 31.22 meters, 9.61 megacycles per second. And for the time of our new service for North America, the second one, station DXJ, 41.44 meters, and the frequency of 7.24 megacycles per second. Which I'd like to mention that there is no copyright reserved on our news. Germany calling with the second news for North America. Events in Norway have now developed into a gigantic contest between the battleship and the airplane. While units of the British fleet are making desperate efforts to force their way to the coast so that troops may be landed, swarms of German fighting aircraft are incessantly raining a hail of bombs down on every ship that approaches within striking distance. Thus, despite the combined efforts of France and England, it has been impossible, up to now, to land more than a few detachments at isolated points along the rocky coast where there are no lines of communication or other means of gaining access to strategically important points. Nor has any progress been made by the Allies in the greatly advertised plan of cutting off Germany's communications to Norway across the Skagerrak. More and more German troop transports continue to arrive in Oslo, unhampered by any action on the part of France and England. The widely announced minefields that the London radio spoke about so much the other day as having been laid in the Baltic and the North Sea evidently have boiled down to a huge bluff. Meanwhile, Narvik continues to remain in German hands, despite announcements almost every day to the contrary by the British wireless. And as the German army in Norway continues to grow larger from day to day, it is becoming increasingly evident that England has lost one of the greatest battles in its history. With the western coast of Norway securely in German hands, German bombers, as an Italian expert pointed out the other day, have now been moved 50% nearer to England's vital industrial centers and naval bases. The resistance offered by scattered groups of Norwegian troops and irregulars cannot be regarded as of any great military significance, since all strategic centers of mobilization, as well as all important railway lines, are occupied or controlled by the German forces. Moreover, the major equipment of the Norwegian army is in German hands. Thus, resistance by the Norwegians is confined to blowing up a bridge here and there and blocking the roads of the advancing Germans as best possible. While this may retard the advance slightly, it cannot hold it up. The real sufferers of that kind of warfare always are the civilian population. Thus, the old English method of inciting a population to useless resistance and then leaving it in the lurch is well on the way to being repeated in Norway. Meanwhile, the British radio spread the absurd report that swarms of German bombers had been sent out with orders to bomb King Haakon. This falsehood was followed by an even more ridiculous story, that the handful of British troops that have succeeded in finding caves and crevices in the cliffs of Norway's coast to hide in are already 60 miles from Oslo and have retaken Hamar. I spell Hamar, H-A-M-A-R. That report obviously was destined for home consumption and possibly for ill-advised King Haakon and his entourage of regulars. But the events of the week also show how keenly the Allies sense the terrific defeat they have suffered in Scandinavia. American radio listeners will recall how the Allies laughed and sneered at what they called the trap Germany was in. That was before Germany nipped England's carefully worked out scheme of occupying Norway in the bud by beating her to it by a bare several hours. Now, within a brief fortnight, the tables are completely turned. All eyes are now turned on the Balkans. Last week, the British diplomatic representatives who had assembled in London to receive new instructions returned to their posts.
Yes.
Ever since, the air is full of rumors and reports indicating that apparently something is about to happen in southeastern Europe. A further indication of this may be seen in the move by Paris and London in Rome and Moscow. Both capitals have been requested to define their attitude and to state whether they intend to stick to their previous conception of neutrality or not. With two British haughtiness, a sort of questionnaire has been sent out to these two big powers containing a number of questions which London and Paris expect to have answered. Meanwhile, everything is being done to turn the Balkans into an economic battlefield. But it is more than likely that in this respect as well, the Allies will suffer a keen disappointment. The Balkans know only too well the value of a good customer, and their best customer is Germany. Meanwhile, Marshal Pétain, speaking in Madrid, told the United States what he expected Mr. Roosevelt to do for France if he is re-elected to a third term. And Italy continues to pursue a policy of watchful waiting, while the Italian press openly states that the death knell of the British Empire has sounded. And so, friends in North America, we bring to a close this summary of events of the week and will now continue with the latest news. This is Germany calling. Germany calling. Stations on the 19, 31 and 41 meter bands. On April the 19th and the 20th, the German Air Force successfully counteracted enemy landing operations supported by naval units in various Norwegian fjords. On April 20th, an enemy cruiser was sunk by bombs of the heaviest caliber, while a second cruiser was put out of action by direct hits. A 15,000-ton transport ship was set on fire and another transport badly damaged. Thus, during April the 19th and the 20th, the German Air Force either sank or heavily damaged four enemy cruisers and five transport steamers. The carrying out of landing operations in Norway, which the Allies now seem to have decided upon, necessitates the bringing into action of all those British naval units which have so far been kept safely at home, irrespective of losses. The consequence of this decision will be the gradual disablement and destruction of the so-called British Grand Fleet. Now that more favorable weather conditions are setting in, the German Air Force will be able to unfold to the fullest extent its striking power. Although 8,000 rifles, 315 machine guns, and the ammunition belonging to them have been captured in the Narvik district, German losses have been extraordinarily slight. Enemy naval units have caused damage in the town only by their senseless bombardment, and Narvik remains firmly in German hands. The appeasement of Norway is proceeding according to plan, both from the occupied coastal towns and the Oslo district. The rapid advance of the German forces along the rivers north of Oslo has practically turned into a pursuit. Mountain artillery is proving most effective in breaking the Norwegian resistance in this area. The enormous quantities of rifles, machine guns, pistols, and ammunition captured in the Bergen district make any attempt at a mobilization in western Norway futile. The guns captured include nearly all calibers, ranging from 2-inch to 10-inch guns. In addition, numerous anti-aircraft batteries, searchlights, flying boats, etc., have fallen into German hands. A German submarine has sunk a former Polish destroyer off the Shetlands, whilst German anti-submarine defense units continue to operate successfully in the Skagerrak. On the Western Front, air activity has become livelier due to better visibility. Five enemy planes were shot down, while one German plane crashed during an air encounter. The German Air Force continued its reconnaissance flights over eastern and northern France, and the enemy again violated Luxembourg, Belgium, and Netherlands territory when approaching the German frontier. This is Germany calling. Germany calling North America. Stations on the 19, 31, and 41 meter bands. We continue the news. Further details of yesterday's successful attack by the German Air Force on British naval units off Andalsnes have now come in. Andalsnes, I spell A-N-D-A-L-S-N-E-S. The first bombs dropped by German planes must have put out of action the rangefinder and other instruments of the anti-aircraft defenses of a heavy cruiser, for the enemy anti-aircraft batteries stopped firing for a short time. When fire was resumed, the aim was so poor that the German pilots could calmly observe the effect of their bombs without danger to themselves. For the first time, therefore, eyewitnesses have been able to report in detail on the effect of bomb hits. The different reactions of the crews of the various ships that were hit are particularly interesting. The heavy British cruiser received a direct hit in the ships from a bomb of the heaviest caliber, whereupon the ship slowly heeled over and began to sink stern first. The German pilots then observed how the crew took to the boats in a disciplined and calm manner, as if they were going through a drill. Quite different from this disciplined attitude, however, was the conduct of the crew of the 15,000-ton transport steamer, which received two hits on the deck from bombs of medium caliber. The bomb which hit the stern of the ship caused fire to break out, which spread rapidly. Although the ship did not go down, hundreds of the soldiers jumped overboard in a panic. It is believed that the tubes which had not yet been landed lost their nerves, as they were evidently unaccustomed to the sea. Furthermore, the boats which were lowered were so overcrowded that they capsized. When the second British cruiser was hit, a sheet of flames shot up immediately, whereupon the cruiser made for the beach at full speed and ran aground. In this case as well, the landing of the crew proceeded in a disciplined manner. A second transport began to go down immediately after having been hit just in front of the funnel by a bomb. Signor Mussolini, in a short speech from the balcony of the Palazzo Venezia in Rome, today declared, I quote, "In this particularly eventful time, the watchword must be work and arm. I am convinced that this watchword will be followed by the entire Italian people, from the Alps to the most distant coasts of the Empire," unquote. The huge crowd assembled before the Palazzo Venezia responded to the Duce's words with roaring cheers. "Italy must be prepared from hour to hour," this says Signor Ansaldo, and the newspaper Telegrafo must be the daily watchword of every Italian. Replying to the self-righteous assertions of some English clergymen claiming that God was the ally of Great Britain, Reverend Hufner of the Trinity Church in Berlin in today's sermon said, "I cannot imagine that our Lord is taking sides with one of the belligerents. The eternal, all-embracing Spirit of God is more universal than the British Empire." Referring to the 51st birthday of the Führer, whom he described as an idealist, Reverend Hufner pointed out that idealism is a fundamental characteristic of Christianity. "It is the spirit that quickens, the flesh produces nothing. I ask you," continued the Reverend, "to stand firm both as Christians and as Germans. We now form one great community. What therefore God has joined together, let no man put us under." Concluding his sermon, the Reverend Hufner said, "Even our political enemies will learn that the Protestant Church of Germany has at least the same right of existence as their own church." And this is the end of our second news from Berlin.
The program originally scheduled for this time will not be heard. Instead, we present Peter Tompkins, Mutual's American Observer in Rome, with his observations on the latest developments in the European situation. We take you now to Rome, Italy.
Hello, Mutual. This is Peter Tompkins speaking from Rome. Today, Rome celebrated the 2,695th anniversary of its founding and of the flagged and sweltering city. All thought of war was temporarily relegated, both in people's minds and in the press, to the back pages. Crowds were on the streets early in the morning, and no one thought of work, as April 21st is also Italy's Labor Day. The busiest man in Rome was Il Duce, who both yesterday and today has been hurrying from one place to the next, building, tearing down, inaugurating, and prize-giving. There was so much on the program that little space was left in the newspapers and practically none on the front pages for the reported German victories in Scandinavia, which have been, for the last few days, the regular fare in the form of 8-column streamers. After a momentous week, Rome seems to be taking on its regular appearance again. Trippers taking advantage of the weather were off to the sea, and most of the diplomatic corps were on the golf links or their terraces. The feeling on the whole is that the balloon of last week's tension here has been pricked. The British diplomatists, who had been busy packing their bags last week and destroying any incriminating evidence which might come into the wrong hands in the event of a blitzkrieg, are now spending a sunny Sunday afternoon unpacking them again. The debacle, they so certainly expected, has been postponed. But for how long, of course, nobody knows. Today, the Italian press has gone back to the familiar headlines of peaceful industry, such as the streamer in the Gazzetta del Popolo. The Duce inaugurates new works for the monumental beauty of the city and for the racial and social betterment of the people. Nevertheless, the also familiar warning that Italy stands ready for any eventuality with her musket at her side is everywhere in evidence. The morning press foreshadowed in bold letters the contents of Signor Mussolini's short speech from his balcony on the Palazzo Venezia. Crowds waited in the midsummer sun for what might have been a momentous speech after the Duce returned from inspecting the fascist youth. At 11:30, the fascist labor confederations collected in the square. At 11:57, the Duce came out on the balcony. He was wearing the gray-green uniform of Commander General of the fascist militia. As he came out, everyone in the square cheered, waved flags, and shouted, Viva il Duce! Mussolini then raised his arm in a salute, and in a few brief words, which lasted actually, and by watch, less than 1 minute, welcomed them on Rome's birthday. His words were, In this particularly eventful moment, and on this day of the Festival of Labor, the watchword is labor and arms. I am certain that this watchword will be heeded by all the Italian people, from the Alps to the seas of the Empire. That was all. There was no portentous speech on foreign affairs. There was no throwing down the gauntlet. Just a few words of welcome to simple folk drawn from the artisans of Rome. Somehow, the crowd did not seem to expect more, and as soon as Il Duce had finished speaking, they turned away and began scattering to their homes, talking about the midday meal and home affairs. There was no tension in the air. There was no war atmosphere. It was a sunny day in Rome, and the people were out to see Il Duce. This is the impression that pervaded the city. A week ago, people were talking anxiously, and the press was vehement. There were no bounds to rumors. Every man, every other man you met, saw a war around the corner, and each one had a different reason, the Balkans, the Mediterranean, or the Allies figuring as the starting point. It was very incoherent, but very vivid. It was so vivid that even some of the solidest neutral observers wondered whether things were not coming to a head over the weekend. But these observers forgot many things which are fundamental. If a nation is going to war in the immediate future, it begins to take precautions which everyone can see. Anti-aircraft refuges have to be built. The population has to be accustomed to blackouts. Gas masks have to be distributed. There are now one to every 50 inhabitants, and many of them are not sure how to use them. Furthermore, it is not possible to call up large numbers of troops without this being noticed. It is claimed, of course, that a bomb cannot penetrate more than about 3 stories of most well-built Italian houses, but the risk would not be worth experimenting. It is claimed also that the population has had sufficient blackout training during the first part of September last. Yet at that time, the lights of Rome could be seen distinctly from the Alban Hills, 20 miles from Rome, and one could still read a newspaper by one of the bluish street lights. Also, a nation which may be going to war with a power in control of the seas does not send one of its best ships off to America a few days before the war. The Saturnia sailed last Wednesday, according to schedule. As a pendulum swings to and fro, so do the so-called crises gradually appear and disappear. The events of last week, with the strong anti-Allied press campaign, look to many as if they might bring complications to Italy. But again, the danger mark seems to have receded out of sight. The press campaign against the Allies, which reached its climax in midweek, has given way almost entirely to the varied activities which have taken place over the weekend. The host of preliminary and minor inaugurations of public works, archaeological restorations, and the like, which preceded the celebration of the traditional founding Rome, have relegated the war in Scandinavia to the back pages. Things do not just happen here. They occur because precise directions have been given. Under such an arrangement, the surface symptoms have a definite diagnostic value. If the anti-Allied campaign in the press is more subdued, it is because it was considered too strong, given the circumstances as they developed past the middle of the week. Yet behind the festive atmosphere of today's celebrations, the bogey of war still lurks. The bright sunlight and gaily colored streets have not altogether been able to dispel its shadow. The press still carries small anti-Allied comments, and one of them in today's extremist newspaper, the Resto del Carlino, shows the present is only a temporary rest in the diplomatic and polemical war. Speaking of the reasons which led Italy to enter the last war in 1917, it says that it was necessary above all for Italy not to be absent from so vast a conflict in which the future of Europe was at stake. He points out the fallacy into which Spain, Denmark, and Norway fell when they thought they would evade the fatal laws of humanity. This war, he obviously infers, is also one in which Italy will eventually and inexorably have to enter. But these so far are words. Deeds may follow as best they can. Last night in British diplomatic circles, the atmosphere seemed tense. Though few Italians had heard the broadcast of Monsieur Paul Reynaud's communique, in which he said of Italy that she would have to define her position, the thought that Italy might have to choose her partner for the dance, or decide once and for all to sit this one out, was causing some anxiety. If the Allies were to push their point, said one British diplomat to me last night, and it looks as if they may, there seems to be no way out. She cannot back down, so she'll have to fight. Yet there were those who said the recent coal controversy between Great Britain and Italy would undoubtedly lead to a rupture. There was no way out, they said, yet a perfectly satisfactory solution was arrived at. It takes two to fight a war, and if a way out is really desired, it can usually be found. Today, those parts of Monsieur Reynaud's communique which mentioned Italy's having to take some sort of stand were omitted in the Italian press. It is obvious from this omission that there is no particular desire to pick a quarrel. At the same time, one may fairly draw the inference that there is no immediate desire to make up along the lines indicated by Monsieur Paul Reynaud, or at least to give the people a premature impression of settlement. Given Italy's present point of view, an understanding in the Mediterranean is not an easy thing to work out. Signor Gaida, who speaks with a good deal of authority, has recently been treating of Italian aspirations in this area. He took the attitude that Italy, being born, as it were, in the Mediterranean, had natural rights which could not be claimed by other nations whose presence there was adventitious. Italians were natives of the Mediterranean. The French and British were foreigners, or at best only naturalized there, according to this Italian commentator. Their power in the Mediterranean, he claimed, was established prior to Italy's awakening. He claims that their control of this island, this inland sea, based on a sort of gendarmerie established at the gates and salient points within this sea, is protecting interests which are not vital to these nations, as freedom of entrance and exit is vital to Italy. The other side of the question is well known. England claims her imperial lifeline to India and the Far East must be safeguarded through the Mediterranean. France claims that her commerce with Africa must be assured in order to permit development of these regions in peacetime and their defense in war. On this fundamental question of vital interests, the viewpoints are in contrast. Gaida suggests a sort of condominium of the key strongholds. Whether this can be worked, whether some other peaceful solution can be found, or whether the matter must be settled by war, which settles nothing, is a problem which is now urgent, but its ultimate solution cannot yet be foreseen. This was Peter Tompkins speaking from Rome. I now return you to New York.
We bring you a special transoceanic broadcast from Paris presenting Waverly Root, Mutual's American reporter in the French capital, who reports this evening on the latest developments in France. Since France is at war, naturally a censorship prevails. We take you now to Paris.
Good evening, America. There will be no sleep tonight for many of the 6 million odd inhabitants of the only Scandinavian country which has still managed to keep out of the European war. For it is beginning to look as though the invasion of Sweden might be a matter of hours. A few days ago, Germany, finding her supply lines to her troops in northern Norway cut off, asked Sweden for permission to send supplies across her territory and to use the Swedish telephone and telegraph systems for their direction. Swedish Foreign Affairs Minister Günther said no, and Germany immediately applied the heat. For 4 days, German planes have been flying across Swedish territory to maintain contact with troops in Norway, thus avoiding Allied patrols and being able to use different air drones from those which the Royal Air Force has been attacking. Swedish anti-aircraft guns have been firing on them. In the Urv this morning, Genevieve Tabouis writes that several German planes were shot down, but that the news has been suppressed to avoid alarming the public. There is no precise confirmation of this report, but the Swedish radio seemed to confirm it generally when it announced that, quote, our anti-aircraft defense has proved that the neutrality of Sweden cannot be violated with impunity, end of quote. At the same time, Sweden protested to Berlin about this use of her territory to avoid attack. It is the case of the German warships using Norwegian territorial waters to keep out of the way of the Allied fleet all over again. Germany replied frigidly, if not with very great logic, that in the first place, the Swedish government had no proof of the allegations of local authorities that German planes had flown overhead, and in the second place, that they had only flown over by mistake. More ominous indications are appearing elsewhere. German forces in the Oslo region appear to be trying to push eastward. In other words, towards the Swedish border, at the point which foreigners have been ordered to leave. German troops are reported to have been massed on the Danish island of Bornholm, just south of Sweden. Other troop concentrations are occurring in East Prussia, notably at Memel, where several divisions are reported to have arrived, ready to embark. More probably for Sweden than for Norway, as you could see by looking at the map. All the ports of this region are strongly guarded, and civilians are not allowed in the neighborhood of the docks. These deeds may speak louder than words, but Germany's words are getting pretty noisy, too. Both her press and her radio have gone to work on Sweden. One of their chief targets is the Swedish newspaper Svenska Dagbladet, which carried a story reporting that German flyers in Norway had opened machine gun fire on women and children in open fields. A speaker of the Reich radio declared that, quote, Germany is not disposed to tolerate the sullying of the honor of the German army, end of quote. With curiously similar choice of words, the semi-official Berliner Börsen-Zeitung wrote that, quote, the Svenska Dagblad wants to sully the honor of the German army, end of quote, and declared that it considered publication of such matter as an act contrary to neutrality. Another Berlin paper is of the opinion that it is also contrary to neutrality that Stockholm should permit the presence of, quote, the Norwegian agitator Hambro, end of quote, meaning the president of the Norwegian parliament, whose obstinate resistance to the beneficent invasion of the Reich has led the Berlin local Anzeiger to the conclusion that Hambro can't be a pure alien. Do these ominous troop movements and this storm of attack mean that Sweden is about to be invaded, or do they simply constitute another battle in the war of nerves with the objective of frightening Sweden into conceding passage for German military supplies across her territory? Little attention is being paid to the fact that a German economic mission has just arrived in Stockholm, with the announced object of conducting negotiations for commercial exchanges between Sweden and Germany. if the idea is to browbeat Sweden into acquiescence, that innocent-appearing economic mission might turn out to have very different functions. But if Sweden refuses to be browbeaten, and she seems to be pretty tough just at the moment, the alternative might have to be invasion, whether Germany really wants to risk more men in the inhospitable north or not. In Paris, at least, most prophets tonight expect just that. Harry Soir writes, quote, "We have rather the impression that in order to try to maintain herself in Norway, there remains hardly anything the Nazis can do except to invade Sweden. And that is what they are preparing to do," end of quote. The authoritative talk, in its customary ponderous language, says, quote, "Certain information tends to make it be supposed that the government of the Reich is envisaging operations which would have for their consequence the extension of hostilities to the whole of Scandinavia. The idea is that the Germans can hardly try to reinforce quickly enough the positions which they seized in Norway by surprise, except by breaking a path through Swedish territory. An aggression against Sweden would be of particular gravity, for in the weeks in which they have been living in a state of permanent alarm, the Swedish people have applied themselves to strengthening their defenses, and the Germans, in violating the neutrality of Sweden, would, it cannot be doubted, run up against the most energetic resistance. It is nonetheless true that everything is occurring as though Herr Hitler was preparing to attempt this adventure," end of quote. It is true also that everything is occurring as though the Swedes were preparing to start strong resistance. This may astonish those of you who are convinced by Sweden's refusal to let the Allied expeditionary force pass through Finland and the failure to declare war to aid Norway, that she hadn't sufficient courage to stand up to Germany. If she is bold now, there may be good reasons for it. One of them I mentioned in a broadcast 2 weeks ago, that she had seriously reduced her own military supplies by the aid she had sent to Finland and was not herself prepared to fight. She has been working feverishly the time she has gained since the invasion of Norway, and it is possible that her stocks have now been replenished to a safer point. Another reason was given this morning by the French political writer Petain, who said in the order that Russia was encouraging Sweden to resist Germany, whereas at the time of the Finnish War, Russia and Germany together were exerting pressure on Sweden. This fits in, incidentally, with present very interesting, important developments of Russian policy, which time, unfortunately, does not permit me to examine for you now. Whatever her reasons, Sweden is showing a determination to meet invasion, if it comes, as resolutely as the Norwegians did. Moreover, she has learned a few lessons from Norway's experience. If she cleared all foreigners out of the provinces on the southern half of her border with Norway, it was no doubt because she was not risking any fifth column action at that vital spot. It was probably because she remembered the Trojan horse ship in Narvik Harbor, whose peaceable merchant crew turned into an expeditionary force when the word was given, that she refused entrance to her territorial waters to five armed German vessels. She has moved the troops stationed in the north during the Finnish War to her boundary with Norway. Other detachments have been placed at the most likely points of attack by landing parties, such as Malmö, which is only a ferry boat ride across the strait from Copenhagen, and Helsingborg, closest point to Denmark, where you can look from Sweden across an arm of the sea hardly wider than a river into the grounds of Hamlet's castle at Elsinore. Preparations have been completed for the voluntary evacuation of the Malmö region. In all Sweden's large cities, inflammable material has been removed from attics, with one person appointed in every building to see to it that this is done. Banks have warned their clients not to keep large sums of money at home, and at the same time have urged on them the advantages of buying government bonds.
We have brought you a special transoceanic broadcast from Paris, presenting Waverly Root, Mutual's American reporter in the French capital. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.